Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Alibaba is going public, and it's going to be one of the biggest IPOs in history. That means big money for lots of people. How about for the stock exchange it'll trade on? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura. Kai Ryssdal is in Mississippi for the rest of the week for our American Futures Project. It's Wednesday, May the 7th, and it's great to have you with us. We don't know what Alibaba's ticker symbol will be, or whether the Chinese e-commerce company will be listed on NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange, but we're pretty sure that both exchanges are falling all over themselves trying to land the listing. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour says it may not be for the reason you think.
Alibaba. It's worth maybe $150 billion. It's from China. Can you imagine what it would mean to the NYSE or NASDAQ to have it list with them?
What it means in terms of revenue to the stock exchange is not very much.
Yep, it's basically a rounding error. That's Joel Hasbrook, by the way, professor of finance at NYU's Stern School. There are a few ways a stock exchange makes money. One is trading fees.
They do get a little bit of money. Well, it's actually less than a few cents when trading occurs.
Fees are cool, but there's a problem.
A substantial amount of trading volume is going to be going on in other stock exchanges.
There are dozens of places you've probably never heard of where stocks are traded, and competition has driven fees down. In 2013, the New York Stock Exchange made about $200 million from all of its fees on stock trading here and in Europe. That's a lot, but
it's sort of dwarfed by the transaction fees that they get from the derivatives business, which is about $1.4 billion.
That's Craig Pirong at the University of Houston. Any one company is going to be pretty negligible. So why do stock exchanges care about who lists with them?
Free advertising.
Prestige. It's a way to stand out. Having a huge, flashy company like Alibaba list with you might attract other huge and flashy companies to list with you.
So really, they really just want Alibaba because they want to be cool.
I mean, that's a big part of it. There's definitely.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Alibaba could be valued at $150 billion. How's that math work? Well, we have the answer at marketplace.org. Stanford University has bowed to pressure from students. It'll become the first major university to divest itself of carbon-producing fossil fuel investments, coal mining companies. We wondered how easy a time Stanford will have canceling out all those coal-related investments. After all, coal is used widely by utilities, and it still generates nearly 40% of U.S. electricity. Sally Herships reports.
If you don't want it, don't buy it. Not investing in coal, that easy.
Clearly, if you don't want to invest in coal, you can not invest in the coal miners.
Christopher Inton is an equity analyst with Morningstar. He says companies that produce coal, like Peabody and Consol Energy, are listed individually on the S&P 500, so they're easy to target. But avoiding the energy source gets more complicated if you try to become a coal vegan and even avoid companies that burn it, like steel manufacturers and utilities. And he says for investors, institutional or otherwise, not buying coal right now is not a hardship. Prices are down.
Anytime there's been press on potential EPA regulations or anything like that, we've always seen a direct impact on coal miner stocks.
But even if more schools like Stanford stop investing in coal, it's not likely to have much impact on sellers. That's according to David Beard, an analyst with Iberia Capital Partners. He says just look at conscience investing campaigns of the past.
I don't see any real economic impact, just given how the stock of Coke and Pepsi and Philip Morris have performed over time. And just because you sell a stock, it really doesn't affect how much money the company has in their bank account to invest in their business.
Beard says the bigger risk for energy companies would be a global carbon tax, which would raise the cost of electricity. But in the meantime,
you know, again, it's supply and demand. If the price is higher than the cost, people will mine it.
In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little up and a little down. Fed Chair Janet Yellen was up on the Hill. She says the Fed will keep interest rates low for a considerable time. Details when we do the numbers. The polls were open today in South Africa. It's that country's fifth election since apartheid ended back in 1994. The African National Congress is the ruling party, led by President Jacob Zuma, and the ANC is expected to stay in power. But South Africa faces a lot of challenges, especially when it comes to how its voters are doing economically. We've got Matt Davis on the line. He's a BBC correspondent based in Johannesburg who's been covering the elections. Hi, Matt.
Hello, David.
Elections are, of course, about politics and parties and all of that. But there are big issues, of course. And I wonder, as you sort of make your way around Johannesburg, what have people been talking to you about? What's driving them to the polls?
Well, the big issues in this elections are basically the economy, which has been stalling in recent years. Unemployment is a big issue here. Nearly a quarter of people are unemployed. And another big issue is, of course, corruption. Corruption is particularly endemic here, and people get very fed up with it. And it was a big issue in the elections.
Let me start with inequality. And I've heard you describe this disparity between insiders and outsiders. Tell me a bit more about that.
This is a thing that a lot of people talk about. It's almost as if South Africa has two economies. The insider economy, if you're in the inside there, it's great. You've probably got a job, you've got a house, and life is looking pretty good. If you're outside of the economy, you're most likely unemployed, you're probably living in a shanty town, and you live in a shack, and you probably don't have much in the way of sanitation. And there really are these two tears, if you like, to the South African economy.
Matt, how much has life changed there in South Africa since the end of apartheid? Measurably so?
It's completely changed to what it was under apartheid. The trouble is, a lot of people have missed out on the economics of freedom, if you like. A lot of people have been left behind, and their lives actually haven't been enriched in the past 20 years. Now, one of these places that I went to is called Bekkersdal. It's about 40 miles southwest of Johannesburg, and ironically, it's actually in the middle of a whole bunch of gold mines. So there's a lot of wealth under the ground, but there is absolutely none on top. And people there have been completely disillusioned with the ANC. But the ANC itself says, well, hang on, we had 250 years of colonialism, 50 years of apartheid. You know, we've only had 20 years. We can't right every wrong. Give us a chance. It'll work itself out.
How does race still play into how well people are doing there economically?
Well, in a nutshell, 85% of whites are relatively wealthy, and 85% of blacks are relatively poor. So in essence, there is an argument that says that back in 1994, political apartheid came to an end. Yes, there was freedom and democracy, but economic apartheid still exists, and that is the thing that needs to be readdressed to rebalance the economy.
Matt, you grew up in South Africa, and this is the fifth election since the end of apartheid. How does this one look to you or feel to you compared to those others?
Well, I suppose we all remember the television footage of the 1994 election, those shots from the helicopters with the huge queues that would snake around places like Soweto, and people would queue for hours to cast their votes. Now, there have been queues today when I've been out and about, but significantly less. And from what locals were telling me, significantly less from even 10 years ago. So there is this feeling that the excitement about being free in 94 has sort of, it's calmed down a bit. I suppose it would 20 years later.
Matt Davis is covering the South African elections for the BBC. Thank you very much, Matt.
Thank you, David.
Boarded-up buildings can be dangerous, and vacant homes drag down neighborhood property values. Cities across the country struggle with blight, and that's especially true in the Northeast. Philadelphia used to have around 2 million residents, but its population declined by more than 500,000, and that led to many abandoned buildings. Today, Philadelphia has come up with a novel solution to stop blight. Alana Semuels of the Los Angeles Times has that story.
Building Inspector Derek McCall spends much of his day in a noisy city truck making his way through a list of 25,000 vacant properties in Philadelphia.
My main purpose at this point is to inspect vacant properties. I'll go by a property to see the condition of the property and to see if it has boarded doors and windows on it and to attempt to bring it into compliance. This is one that I have to stop by.
If a home does have plywood covering its doors and windows, McCall staples a bright pink poster on the door, informing the owner it's a blighted property. The fine for each boarded up door or window is $300 per opening per day.
I basically wrote it up to repair the five windows, and I wrote it to repair the front steps and the porch floor.
The idea behind the strategy is to force building owners to fix up their homes and make them habitable, or to sell them to someone who will. Rebecca Swanson manages the city's vacant property strategy. She says fixing blight in one house will stop it from spreading to others.
We can make them do something now, and if we catch them now, we're going to get to a point where we can save it from having to be something that's going to fall further into disrepair and we're going to have to demolish.
It's pretty expensive for a city to tear down vacant buildings, like $15,000 a house. But forcing the owners to fix up their properties can actually make the city money.
And then we found all these tangential benefits as we've gone. Increased tax collection, improved neighborhoods, getting more revenue through licenses and permits.
In the neighborhood specifically targeted by the city, home sale prices rose 31%. Ira Goldstein is with the Reinvestment Fund, a group that finances neighborhood development.
If you're smart and you're targeted and you're focused and you send a very clear market signal that blighting properties are not going to be tolerated in a place, then what you do is you end up signaling to the market that this is a place where investment can be made and profitably made.
It's a lesson for other cities that have thousands of vacant properties to deal with. Cleaning up blight takes time, but it can be done. In Philadelphia, I'm Alana Semuels for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There's people that still like holding a book, people that still like turning the page. And, we're trying to get those people to come in.
Running a comic book store in the digital age. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 117 points, 0.75%, to finish at 16,518. The NASDAQ fell 13 points, 0.33%, to close at 4067. And the S&P 500 added 10 points, 0.5%, to end the day at 1878. Tech stocks took another hit. Salesforce.com gave back 2.6%. Facebook slipped 2%. Electronic Arts raced up the field for a 21% gain. The maker of Madden NFL and The Sims predicts stronger earnings over the coming year. Molson Coors Brewing tapped 3.6% higher on stronger-than-expected earnings. Whole Foods pulled nearly 19% off the shelves today. Sales fell as other grocery stores ramp up their organic food offerings. Bond prices were largely unchanged. The yield on the 10-year T-note held steady at 2.59%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, a Senate subcommittee on tourism, competitiveness, and innovation discusses a plan to attract 100 million international visitors annually by the end of 2021. In New York City, the first round of the NFL draft takes place. And across the country, are consumers shopping? Chain stores are scheduled to report April sales. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura in for Kai Rizdal. And now the latest from the social media make traditional media go awry department. And we've been visiting that department a lot lately. Today's story is about Coca-Cola and a recent ad campaign for Diet Coke. It was, as so many of these often are, a campaign aimed at young people. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, it's another example of how Twitter and Tumblr and Facebook and all the rest can, shall we say, detract from a company's message. Here's Mitchell.
Ms. Curtis, you're on.
That's one of the Diet Coke ads that's giving the digital peanut gallery such fun. Young people doing nervy things, moving to New York to become a DJ, giving a big speech, Oh, and here's a cool fresh pick-me-up, a Diet Coke, by their side. Next in the TV ad, we see Taylor Swift in her dressing room.
Taylor, you're on.
You're on, meaning the stage, and then the rest of the tagline, Diet Coke. But take out the diet, it can become You're On Coke. The jokes go on from there.
Whenever a brand puts its message out there, if it's open to interpretation, then they're just asking for people to have fun with it.
Tony Kelso teaches advertising at Iona College in New York, and he says young consumers have the digital tools and no compunction at all about mashing up and satirizing ads. Just imagine the dark and twisted up-your-nose scenarios that have already been tacked onto You're On Coke and tweeted and retweeted ad infinitum. Media analyst Jack Myers says these are the new rules of the digital game.
Advertisers just need to be comfortable being less careful and letting the market take their messages and hack at will.
Coke has reportedly pulled its ad campaign. The company didn't respond by our deadline. But maybe all the buzz isn't so bad. After all, the brand needs more young consumers. They're grabbing energy drinks instead, the better to stay up all night hacking ads and things. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
A lot of companies are paying attention to a court case in Colorado. That's because it could change the way employers test employees for drugs. The case involves a medical marijuana patient, and it centers on this question. Do companies have a say in their workers' legal drug use outside of work? From Denver, Nova Sappho explains.
So far, the answer to that question when it comes to legalized pot use has been yes. Multiple court rulings say private employers that test for drugs don't have to prove their employees were high at work before firing them. But all that could change at the Colorado Supreme Court in a case involving Dish Network and Brandon Coates.
I worked for Dish Network for 3 years. I was a customer service representative.
In 2010, Coates and dozens of his coworkers were subjected to a random drug test. Coates knew he wouldn't pass. He's a quadriplegic, paralyzed in more than 80% of his body, and he uses medical marijuana to calm muscle spasms.
In the part of my body where I'm paralyzed, my body tries to send signals to my head and it doesn't get through and it gets sent back down. And what that causes is for my muscles to flex like really hard.
Coates says he was never high at work, always taking marijuana at night. But Dish Network fired him anyway. The satellite TV company refused an interview, but in an email, it said it's committed to a drug-free workplace policy. Brandon Coates sued Dish, and a state appeals court ruled against him last spring.
What the Court of Appeals came out and held was that employers who have a zero-tolerance drug policy can enforce that, even if someone has a medical marijuana card.
Van Snap is a labor law attorney with the Denver firm Sherman & Howard. He advises Fortune 500 companies on workplace issues.
There have been several other appellate decisions throughout the United States that have all upheld an employer's right to have workplace policies restricting marijuana use.
Knapp says Brandon Coates' case is potentially different because it raises a new question. Can an employee be fired if his legal pot use was explicitly protected by state law? There is such a law in Colorado. It says workers cannot be fired for lawful activities outside of work. The Colorado Supreme Court has now taken up Coates' case, and Knapp says the potential impacts could be big.
Employers really need to keep an eye on this decision. It's not just Mr. Coates.
The state Supreme Court case comes as many companies in Colorado are tightening their drug testing policies. Curtis Graves is with the Mountain States Employers Council. He says companies are responding to a slew of messages that urge drug testing.
There's a great deal of statistics out there that drug use and alcohol cost employers an enormous amount of money, in the hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So, you know, the marketing message is that by drug testing they can save money.
Graves says many employers are also concerned about potential liability if there's an accident and an employee tests positive for pot. But for Brandon Coates, the issues are simpler. He wants to show that being quadriplegic and needing medical marijuana does not prevent him from being a productive worker.
What I would like is just for there to be a point proven so that people in my position, you know, can be employed. That's the main thing.
Coates says in the 4 years since he lost his job, he has not been able to find another one. In Denver, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Wednesday is a big day for comics across the country. It's when new issues hit store shelves. So when I was in Los Angeles last, I stopped by Meltdown Comics in Hollywood. The first thing you notice when you walk in is how many different comics there are. Gotta be thousands in there. There are the old standbys like Spider-Man, there's a lot of anime, there's even Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I had no idea that was still around. And all over the place, there's comics-related stuff. There are figurines and toys, giant posters, cardboard cutouts. And a few employees are in the back, sorting through all the boxes that have just come in, the new shipment of comics. Francisco Dominguez runs the place with his brother. They're originally from Chile, and they opened Meltdown Comics in 1993. And since bookstores of all kinds are pretty much in decline these days, the first thing I asked Francisco is how hard it is to run a comic book store in 2014.
Digital media is killing us. You know, just like record stores, people started downloading music, now they're downloading books and comics. And that's taken effect, but it's not the same as it used to be.
How thin are the margins on a comic book? In other words, when you sell one, what's the margin?
Well,
like?
After the overhead, no, not much. Books, you know, they sell for $2.99. And it costs us 40% of that, you know. We're not making much after employees, lights, and, you know, being on Sunset. Rent's not cheap. We're trying to run a skeleton crew because it's hard times, you know.
Who shops here, if you could characterize that?
25 to 45-year-olds. That's
repeat
mainly
customers,
that's
people
repeat
you've
customers.
Seen before.
A lot of them, they've been coming out here for years. We've seen a lot of them grow up, so which is, you know, it's fun to see. You know, before they were little kids, now they're, you know, they're coming in with their kids. And hopefully, you know, it keeps going like that.
And just another facet of that, if you can buy a comic book online, is that detracting from people who would have come in here to buy it in the past? In other words, I can get it shipped to my house, why would I come in?
Right. I mean, that's happening a lot. But, you know, like I said, there's people that still like holding a book, people that still like turning the page. And, you know, we're trying to get those people to come in. You know, we're trying everything that we could. You know, we have a comedy venue in the back, you know, that attracts more people. Now we started taking cryptocurrency, Bitcoin and Dogecoin, so we're taking those too, so trying to get that crowd to come in. We got to keep it fresh. It's like vegetables, you know, you got to keep turning them around, or else, you know, it just gets rotten and people forget, and people don't like it anymore, or want anymore.
To keep the store fresh and to find new sources of revenue, Meltdown made a new push this year. Francisco introduces us to a guy with a title you wouldn't normally associate with a comic shop.
My name is Justin Sewell. I'm the director of New Media.
Justin says at first, Meltdown was grappling with how to battle the web for survival, and now it's using the web as its strongest weapon.
The key word right now is experience, experiential marketing. You know, and it's not enough anymore to have a line out the store. They want the buzz. They want the cool factor on Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, YouTube, Twitch. Fans in Terre Haute, Indiana, can be part of the fun here in Hollywood. And what we found is people watching online suddenly are like, this has become a destination. Like, I got to go to L.A., I got to see Grauman's Chinese Theater, I got to see Venice Beach, and I got to see Meltdown Comics.
And you've got them. You've got people who are from across the country who go to your site.
Across the country and around the world. We have a lot of people in South American countries and Portugal and Spain. And a lot of this, you know, kind of some of the BRIC countries are getting into comics.
These are the emerging markets.
Now they're discovering all the comics that we've taken for granted for 50, 60 years.
It isn't clear how this will affect Meltdown's future, if the store will continue to be successful, but Francisco says he hopes he'll figure out a way to make it work.
This is a kind of our legacy. So
you see it as that?
Yeah. I mean, 20 years at it. But hopefully it'll stick around for another 20 years, you know. We're trying everything that we can. So, yeah, hopefully, you know, we'll stick around for 20 more.
Francisco Dominguez and his brother run a store called Meltdown Comics in Hollywood.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, which I think would sound a lot better if we can cue up a little John Williams. There we go. We learned today that NBC has bought the rights to broadcast the Olympics through 2032 on TV, over the internet, on mobile devices. The head of Comcast, the company that owns NBC, said securing those broadcast rights for the Olympics is, in his words, an honor and a privilege. Well, that's an honor and privilege that'll cost NBC a reported $7.65 billion, which I should add is just about how much money Alibaba has in cash. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 117 points to finish at 16,518. The NASDAQ fell 13 points to close at 4067. And the S&P 500 added 10 points to end the day at 1878. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Nick Joyce, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the program for us. I'm David Gura. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.